A sermon series on mistakes worth making. And the first thing I've been saying each sermon is we're going to make a lot of these. We're just going to make a lot of mistakes because we're human and we're biased and we're finite. And the amount of knowledge we can have on any given subject is very limited. We have way more opinions on things than we should. And we hold our opinions much too strongly given the limited access to information and rationality that we have. We're just going to make a lot of mistakes, whether it's judging other people, theology, trying to figure out what God's up to. We're just going to be wrong. So the question isn't, are we going to make mistakes or not? The question is, what kind of mistakes should we make? When we're going to make mistakes, what side, where should we make the error, right? I use this, and I mentioned this last Sunday, as one tool when I'm trying to make moral decisions. Like I'm trying to figure out what's the right thing to do when I'm raising my kids or with a student, right? How do I, if I'm going to make a mistake, if I'm not going to get this right, where would I want that mistake to land? And I tend to think that we make it on the side of grace. So I want to say something, and maybe this will be helpful. It's a little bit of what I talked about last week, but I want to try to make it personal. In my darkest moments, in the moments when I feel like when I'm praying, I'm really talking to myself, when God seems totally absent, when it seems like the world is clearly run by chance and quantum activity and natural law, and there's almost no divine activity to be seen, at least it seems that way, right? In my darkest moments, when I feel like what I'm doing is a hoax, what keeps me, what I cling to like as a brick, when some of my faith feels like a house of cards easily blown over, what I cling to as a brick of my faith that does not waver, that I try to like latch onto when I have doubt, it's the overarching logic of the gospel that makes no sense rationally, and yet when you see it lived, it seems obviously true. Right? It's like really practical, and I'll try to explain. So last week I mentioned the notion that people that are hurt, that have had pain and difficulty and neglect in their life, often become cactuses, right? Cactuses don't get enough water, they're in the heat, they're in the elements, and it's actually a beautiful thing that a cactus can adapt to survive in the desert. It's wonderful, right? But that's what happens with broken people who are hurt. They turn into cactuses that are really thorny, and I don't want to get close to them, right? So we talked about this. The problem is, of course, that when you encounter pain and sin and abandonment and brokenness, it's not like you just take it on, you pay it forward. Sin creates a ripple that goes out. I get hurt and then I want to hurt others. And so it spreads. It's like the most effective virus ever. Pain, sin, brokenness. Because when I experience it, I want to pay it forward. And it makes sense that you would pay it forward, logically, right? If I need to adapt to my environment where I don't feel loved, I don't feel really accepted, I don't feel like anyone's really stuck by me, then I've got to adapt. I've got to become a cactus. That's the way you survive. That makes sense. That's the logic of survival. So sin gets paid forward. Here's the only way I know to break it. The only way to break that cycle is for us to take the crazy logic of Jesus and to absorb it into our very bodies. Like I have to be willing to take it in and find a way to not pay it forward. Like you breathe in the pain and you breathe out grace. So last week we read about the stoning of Stephen. Paul, who eventually writes 2/3 of the New Testament, but at this time he is the villain. He's a Pharisee killing Christians. Stephen's an early Christian. They're stoning him to death. Paul sees it and approves. And what are Stephen's words to those throwing stones at his body? Forgive them, Lord. They do not know what they are doing. And Stephen takes the violence into his very body and does not pay it forward. He could call for revolution. He could call every Christian to pick up stones and throw them back at the Pharisees. Let's fight. Let's pay this sin forward. But how do you stop it? Grace. forgiveness. He breathes in the violence and he breathes out grace. What does Jesus do when the crowd is crucifying him, torturing him to death? It's the same exact sentence. Forgive them. The crowd, you know, the ones that are torturing me, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He doesn't call to arms. He doesn't mobilize all of his followers. He does not pay the sin forward. He takes it on. And as much as it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that, when you watch it happen, it's like watching a miracle. When you see forgiveness in action, it's like a miracle. And because this is the logic of the gospel of Jesus, I cling to it. Even when I don't even have an idea what God's up to or whether anyone's listening. I want to live that way. And I can't. I don't know how to do it. Not on my own. Not without you all. Not without some community. Because on my own, sin crushes me. I couldn't possibly bear it and pay grace forward. I can only do it when I'm in the midst of a group of people who can bear it with me. Who can lift me up when I fall down. This is what I'm advocating Steve do. He lifts people up when they fall down, and they lift him up when he falls down. That's how you pay pain forward with grace. So it keeps me tethered in some way. Keeps me grounded to think people hurt because they're hurt. I hurt others because I'm broken. How might I live differently? How might we stop that cycle? But that's not how the world operates. So we have to be countercultural here in this place. We have to provide an alternative to the logic of the way in which society functions, which is an eye for an eye. So today I want to talk a little bit about mistakes worth making, and I want to ask a congregational question. When you make mistakes, what are some of the motives? What are the things that drive those mistakes, good or bad? What often motivate our mistakes? Does that question make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry.
Hurt feelings.
Yeah. Motivates my mistakes is like when I feel slighted or hurt. Yeah, Mike.
Laziness.
Good. I don't want to do it. Like, what we're suggesting here is hard work. The end of the sermon is there are no shortcuts, just so you know. That's where we're going to go. Yeah.
Just reacting.
Yeah, so like my biological reactions, I do it almost instinct, right? So I've got fight, flight, avoid, submit. I mean, I've got like a few basic things, and that often leads to my mistakes is I just respond. Yeah, Jeff.
Greed or self-preservation.
Yeah. I want. What about my needs? So my greed, myself. Yeah. Greg. Ego? I wish that were not true. So one of my favorite psychologists, Jonathan Haidt, says, if you want to know what motivates a person, follow the prestige. Where do they get prestige? So if you think about like kids that misbehave, they often get prestige for misbehaving, right? Like their friends think it's awesome when they make the teacher look stupid. Or like it's cool when you go get high or whatever. You get prestige, you do it. I never got prestige for that in my group. I was like, oh no, I'm like church kid, right? But you know what I get prestige for? Being good. Oh, I love that. But what's that feeding? It's feeding my ego at its worst, right? And that causes all kinds of problems for me, not for all of you, but ego for me is a real trap. Because what I get prestige for is all the right things. But it motivates me to make all kinds of mistakes, yeah.
This kind of goes along with Greg's ego, but when you act out of what you think is the desire to help someone, like, oh, I'm going to save that person, did they ask for your opinion? Did they ask for your help?
Oh, and I'm going to help you.
I'm going to fix you right up.
But yeah, it's like the savior complex.
Yeah.
So if you know the Enneagram at all, right, like Enneagram 2s are like the helper, but often it's like, I'm going to fix it, but it comes across condescending. I haven't listened. This is why, again, I think one of the things that we need to say over and over is our ministry is not to solve the world's problems because we can't. It's to be present to people in pain. So being like the ministry of presence is different than I'm going to make sure I fix it. I'm going to save you.
Ugh. But the people that cause it, they I have...
No, it's good. Let's push back. This is awesome. I feel like I'm in class right now.
I have a sister who is a crisis junkie.
Yeah.
And if there is no crisis for her to solve, she will cause a crisis. So she can fix it.
Yeah. So almost like we get addicted to drama in some ways too, right? Yeah. So all kind of, I mean, we could talk about fear. There's so many things that motivate. And here's, I think, what I'm hoping this sermon series does. Let our mistakes be motivated by a sincere desire to love. Not to fix, not for my ego, not because I'm trying to get some prestige, but legitimately I'm going to make a mistake based, like, motivated by love, motivated by grace, motivated by forgiveness, motivated by the kinds of things that I might get it wrong. I might give too much grace, right? It means I probably will look like a noob and get taken advantage of. That's going to happen. I'm not suggesting we be foolish. I had someone joke with me after the first sermon in the series, and they said, you know, I wasn't going to send that money to the Nambian prince who said I need to send him $10,000 or they were going to execute him. But now maybe I will, right? It's like clearly those email scams. And like my sermon series could be taken that way, right? Oh, like make a mistake, make it on the side of grace. And someone's asking you for money, you just write them a blind check, right? Like, no. Don't do that. I'm not suggesting you are thoughtless in this. But do you know the people that troll emails and try to take advantage of the elderly, try to con them and get money? Do you recognize that people that are whole and happy and fulfilled don't do that kind of work? That desperate, broken, isolated people do that kind of work? So I'm not suggesting you send the money. I am suggesting we could probably still have grace for them, though. Understand that conditions drive that kind of behavior. People aren't born like, I want to be a scam artist when I get older. So I still suggest that we could make a mistake on the side of grace without being foolish. So I want to talk a little bit about love. Being motivated by love, a kind of radical love, not a Hallmark kind of love. The kind of love that requires risk. The kind of love that Ruth takes. I'm not going to read the passage, Mike, but if you want to just put the picture up. You read the story. Ruth and Naomi are vulnerable women with no husbands, and in the ancient world, this meant trouble. There's no reason for Ruth to go with Naomi to Israel. There's no reason. She's a Moabite. She's an enemy when she goes to Israel. She's a husbandless, right, like widow, no power, outsider going to Israel. No one would blame her if she just stayed in Moab. She's not doing anything wrong. She's not breaking some moral rule if she says, peace out, Naomi, I'm going to stay here and get remarried. No one's going to judge her for this. And yet, she goes beyond what is expected or what might be the norm of the culture. She goes beyond and puts Naomi first and loves her. And by the way, it looks like a mistake. If you're there when she's making that decision, and you don't know how it turns out, we know how it turns out, but if you don't know how it turns out, that looks like a horrible choice. All I'm suggesting is, it's the right kind of mistake, because she's doing it for love. Mm-hmm. She cares for Naomi deeply, and wants to know that she's okay. Yes. So she's not going to separate. She's going to make sure she cares for her. That's the kind of mistake that Jesus calls us to make. The early church, people are selling land and giving the money away to the poor. That looks ridiculous. Why would you do that? That looks foolish. But they're motivated by love. It's the kind of mistake that maybe we should make. I'm guessing that there are people here today, I know it to be true, where part of your heart is closed. Part of your heart has just shut down. It's closed because of a particular person that has hurt you. It's closed because you're just disillusioned with the state of the world. You can't take it anymore. It's closed because you've lost a child. It's closed because you've been divorced. It's closed because someone close to you is sick. And that heart begins to shut down. And that's when we make mistakes based on fear. That's when we make mistakes on self-preservation. That's when we make mistakes that break relationship. And what I'm suggesting is that maybe you would find the courage to open that part of your heart up and to make a movement of love, even if it feels a little bit like a mistake. That maybe that movement is actually what will break the cycle of sin. We won't pay it forward anymore, but we'll respond with love. We're going to watch a clip. It's a couple of minutes long. It's from the movie A Beautiful Mind. I think the hero of this is a movie based on an actual human being, right? So it's, I don't know how much of it's true, but it's based on a true story, right? And this person, Dr. Nash, was a genius in mathematics, but he was also a schizophrenic. And he started to refuse to take his medicine because it made it so he couldn't do his work. It also made him a danger to his wife and young child. So now you've got a real problem, right? Like, what do we do? If he takes his medicine, it helps with his schizophrenia, but he can no longer do work. He can't really be a dad. He's almost like a zombie. Again, this is not current medication for schizophrenia. This is old medication, right? If he refuses to take it, just recently, before we watched this clip, he had a hallucination of seeing things that weren't there, and he threatened his wife. Like, he became a threat to her. So now she's faced with the decision, do I institutionalize my husband who won't take his medicine and is a danger to me and my child? Like, how do I do this? What do I do? So you're going to see. No one blames her if she commits her husband. He has schizophrenia. That's not wrong.